Funding for this podcast comes from MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink software, accelerating the pace of engineering and science. Learn more at MathWorks.com.
Support for On Point and the following message comes from Rocket Mortgage by Quicken Loans. Lift the burden of getting a home loan with Rocket Mortgage and get a secure, transparent home loan approval in minutes. Skip the bank, skip the waiting, and go completely online at quickenloans.com/onpoint.
From WBUR Boston and NPR, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. Hiking the Appalachian Trail is a challenge for anyone. 2,200 miles from Springer Mountain, Georgia, to Mount Katahdin, way up in Maine. Anyone can try it. Most don't. Rahawa Hale did it as a young, solo African-American woman. Turns out that's rare. People of color in general are underrepresented in America's national parks and great outdoors. This hour on Point, Rahawa Hale tells us her story, south to north, 2,000-plus miles on the Appalachian Trail. You can join us on air or online, where this conversation is always on. Have you done it? Walked the Appalachian Trail? Was it a white world? Why? Join us anytime at onpointradio.org or on Twitter and Facebook at onpointradio. Joining me now from Berkeley, California is Rahawa Hale, essayist and short story writer. She hiked the Appalachian Trail, all 2,190 miles of it, last summer, and she wrote about her experience in the latest issue of Outside Magazine. Headline, Going It Alone. You can link to that at our website, onpointradio.org. Rahawa Hale, welcome to On Point. Great to have you here.
Hi, Tom. Thank you so much for having me.
So I wanted to know how long it was and look at the map of it again, and I go to Wikipedia, and it's got Appalachian Trail. And then right away it's talking right on the front page about some features, and they include, madam, severe weather, American black bear, tick-borne diseases, mosquitoes, yellow jackets, biting flies, chiggers, steep grades, limited water, dangerous fordings, diarrhea from water, poison ivy, venomous snakes. Why did you want to do this?
Well, you know, it's just the top of the iceberg there. It's the really terrible stuff that got me going. No, I think being outside, even outside on the street, comes with its own perils. And of course, nobody wants to be stung by yellow jackets, and nobody wants to encounter a bear. We have the nicer bears on the East Coast, though, I will say. It's not like I was encountering grizzlies, and they're more frightened of us than we are of them. But, you know, a part of it was what everyone else says. They want to get away from it all. And, you know, one of the most common things you'll hear from fellow hikers as far as why they came out onto the trail is to heal. You know, many people, there are many veterans, there are many people who've lost a parent or a sibling who's dealing with an illness, or people who are dealing with their own issues, people who are looking to restart their lives, people who've retired. For me, I was just at a crossroads where I realized I had the time and I was in decent health. And I'm not that young. I'm 32. But
okay. Yeah, fair.
But,
good.
But I was at a point where I knew that whatever came next, I would never have this much time to do whatever I wanted with. And I at the time, I'd been in New York City for about 7 years, and I felt very detached from the natural world in a way that was entirely unnatural to me. I grew up in Miami. I grew up with the sea and the sand and the wind, and I missed it. And I went up my first mountain, Bear Mountain, because a good friend, John Coyne, took me up it, and it's along the Appalachian Trail. And the first time I followed those white blazes, I was just completely mesmerized. I mean, the thought of, you know, you go on a trail, you don't really think that it'll extend from Georgia to Maine, and this one did. And I said to myself, you know, someday this is something that I'd like to do. And then 2 years later, I did. And, you know, I mean, it's, I will take a second to clarify that there are people who define thru-hike in different ways. There are purists who say you have to hike, you know, all 2,189 miles. There are people who say, you know, over 2,000 miles, because the original trail was about 2,020-something miles long.
All right.
And I fall into the latter category. And I want to give a second to give a shout-out to the purists out there who actually did hike every single inch of the trail. It doesn't matter if there was a heat index of 114 and no water throughout all of Pennsylvania, they did it. But me, I consider myself a through hiker, but I will admit that I'm more of the hiked over 2,000 miles, and that's what
I think we can stipulate that over 2,000 miles a hike is a pretty fearsome hike.
Yes.
You talked about following the white blazes. Or is that what marks this white paint on trees and rocks that mark the trail as you go?
Exactly. So this trail has just tens of thousands of blazes of these on a tree, on a rock, on whatever. There'll be a white stripe. I want to say it's about 2 inches by 6 inches long. And it guides, it tells you, you know, follow here, go around here. And that extends from Georgia all the way to Maine. And that's what it is. You just follow the blazes. And there's a particular piece to knowing what forward looks like every day of your life for 6 months that I have a hard time imagining I'll find again.
Would you just, because many people fantasize about doing it, I have, and just never found the time or the...
You should.
I'm sure I should, but I mean, there's a lot we want to get into with you here, and a lot of it is cultural and social, but just take us over the topography from, sort of walk us, as if we were walking, if you could do time lapse and, you know, in a few minutes, take us through the terrain that you see, starting out from Georgia and ending up in Maine.
Okay, so you're in Georgia, and you're probably unhappy because it's cold and wet. And it's
because it's early in the year, because you want to be done by October at the latest, I guess.
Yes. You know, it's funny. I found out that because it's been so warm this year that many hikers started earlier than usual. Okay. But last year, it was pretty cold and wet up until, I don't know, maybe end of March. And I started on March 23rd on Springer. And it's steepest. The trail is steepest at its two ends, so in the south and in the north. And you don't have, when you show up in Georgia, you don't have your trail body yet. Mm-hmm. You know, you're carrying way too much food. You don't have the right gear. You're not really sure how to set things up, how to throw a bear bag, how to do your tent. Your shoes might not fit. You know, you're dealing with blisters for the first time, and it can be rough. You know, I mean, those first there's a mountain called Mount Albert. And it's at mile 100. And, I mean, if you can make it to Mount Albert, I'm telling you, you can make it the rest of the way.
If you can do that 100 miles, you can do the full 2,000? Okay.
I think so. I mean, you know, of course, injuries and money and whatever else might take people off
the trail. Do you feel like you're in the boondocks most of the time, or are you walking in people's backyards? Are you in woods and trees, or what kind of terrain around?
And, you know, that's a good question. And that's something that people don't realize about the Appalachian Trail, and one of the reasons why it's so popular. And that's because it has so many road crossings. I mean, it's the trail that
it has
to keeps
2,000 miles.
Well, yeah, but I mean, but there's the Pacific Crest Trail, and there's a section in Washington State where you don't have cell phone service for 200 miles. You know, it's a bad place to sprain your ankle. Or you have the last of the three long trails, the Continental Divide Trail, which is 3,000 miles long, and there are very few people who do it. But the Appalachian Trail, there are road crossings all the times, and they came in incredibly useful in Pennsylvania because there was no water. I hiked during the hottest July ever recorded, and it was over 100 degrees every day, and there was no water.
So are you running into, like, convenience stores at these
Sometimes there are convenience stores near maybe a few tenths of a mile or a mile off of the road, but more often than not, it was trail angels, people who know about the Appalachian Trail, who are part of the trail community, who aren't hikers themselves, or maybe they're former hikers, who would leave water caches at road crossings, and they are the only way that I made it through Pennsylvania. I don't know that we'd be having this conversation if it weren't for them. But Georgia's beautiful, steep. North Carolina, Tennessee, you got the Smokies, some of those breathtaking scenery you've ever seen. And then it kind of stops, you know. Virginia, 550 miles of the trail runs through Virginia, roughly a quarter.
Wow.
And by the time most hikers are getting there, most of the leaves have grown in. And so Virginia is kind of considered a green tunnel because you can't really see. You can't see unless you're, on a mountaintop.
Yep.
You can't see beyond the trees because of all these leaves. And so it can get very monotonous, and it's very hard on hikers mentally.
500 miles in a green tunnel. 550, that's a lot.
Exactly. But it's also some of the most spectacular, I mean, scenery. I mean, you're talking about, you know, if you've ever driven the Blue Ridge Parkway or if you've ever driven, through Shenandoah National Park, that's what we're talking about. And it can be spectacular. And the wildlife, I saw bears, I saw bobcats at a distance. at a distance.
Yeah, yeah.
So Virginia's apparently allegedly flat, but I assure you it's not.
Hold the terrain there. We'll come back to it for the grand finale.
Okay.
How long did it take for race to show up as an issue?
And
gender, too, for that matter, if you like, on the trail.
As an issue, it was
to
never
your mind.
An issue. I mean that nobody made it an issue for me. Nobody made it difficult on the trail, as far as hikers are concerned, through hikers, to be me. Every through hiker I encountered was incredibly welcoming and incredibly kind. And I think, as I've said this before, and this will not be the last time I'm saying it, but the through hiking community is just one of the warmest and most open communities I've ever belonged
to.
Yes, but about those road crossings and about those trail towns, you know, it's not when did race become an issue to me on the trail. It's more when was I made aware of my race while walking through America, and that was, I mean, pretty much every other trail town in especially in the South. But you know, it never stops. You know, it's not like these towns are all white for a reason, just in the South. You know,
What was that like? What did you run into?
What did I run into? I mean, you know, the typical things that people run into, even if they're not on the trail. People following me in stores when I'm resupplying. You know, just people staring at you. People just making comments like, we don't see much of your kind around here. The things that people feel at liberty to tell you when you're a hiker and when you're a black hiker is staggering. At least it was for me. But you know, I was often among these fellow through hikers, and I have a hard time imagining one of them wouldn't have stood up for me if they saw someone treating me poorly. And I say this not just as a black person, but as a woman. I mean, there's all kinds of masculinity on the trail. You know, the trail is mostly male, but there was also a lot of looking out for women, and especially for younger women. There are hikers as young as I think 15. There was one hiker, Pebbles. I want to say she was 15 or 16, and everyone looked out for her, especially the men. So there's a lot of support among through hikers. But it's, you know, it's one of the hard things for me was I'd be in town and I wouldn't be able to share that anxiety with anyone.
I'm Tom Asper. This is On Point, the sound of a hiker there on the Appalachian Trail in the White Mountains of New Hampshire. In that case, just to get you out on the trail, audio terms anyway, for a minute, Rahawa Hale did it for 2,000-plus miles, and she's written about it for Outside Magazine. She did it as an African-American woman, which turns out to be not exactly the norm of trail hikers. Lots of support from through hikers, lots of experiences along that trail, many that any hiker would share, and some that most might not, given the way American outdoor spaces tend to be used. You can join us this hour. Why would the Appalachian Trail and maybe other American wilderness or outdoor spaces be generally so white? What is that about? And are African Americans, let's say, not interested, not welcome, just not tuned into the great outdoors? Really? And what's your question for Rahawa Hale on her hike or her experience on hiking while black? I mean, this is kind of a thing. There's even a group called Hiking Every Available Trail, HEAT, and Kiona Dawson helped found the organizations aimed at encouraging more people of color to get outside. And she talked with National Geographic in February this year about growing up and getting into hiking as a young person of color.
I never saw people that really looked like me on the trails. And, you know, I was fortunate enough to, you know, have a father that was a lover of nature, too. And so at an early age, I remember one of our first national parks, we went to Yosemite. And I was just blown away. And we hiked up to the falls. And I've been hooked. I've been hooked ever since.
Rahawa Hale joins us from Berkeley, California. Rahawa, between the music and the bird song there, we all want to get on the trail right now. what about the demographics of what you saw on the trail, the hikers themselves? What was the profile or the spectrum?
I mean, you know, so there's it's very white and very male. But there were so many women when I hiked. I mean, you know, I think the stats are something like, on average, something like 25 to 30% of thru hikers are women. But I really look forward to seeing the new batch of statistics, because I don't think that's true. I mean, I just saw so many women.
You think it's more or fewer? You think it's more?
More, absolutely. I saw so many solo women who started out, and many of them finished, you know?
Is this the Cheryl Strayed effect after Wild and the Pacific Crest Trail story that she wrote so movingly about?
I think part of it is that. I think part of it is about Wild inspiring many women to save up and to tackle you know the trail, but I also think women are really good planners, and I know I was anyway, and I think one of the reasons why many of them many of them finished was because of that tenacity and because of how careful you have to be as a woman with everything, especially out in nature when you're, I think, most vulnerable.
So I'm trying to get a sense. I mean, you wrote a lot about race here in your piece, and yet when you talk about the trail, it doesn't infuse what you're saying.
Well, what do you mean?
Well, thru hikers, awesome. I guess you're saying just demographically, you felt at some level like an outlier and less common as an African American hiking the trail.
Oh yes, yeah, yeah. No, I mean, I definitely there. I think I ran into maybe 10 black people at most, and there was one meeting where four of us were there at the same time, and we talked about our experiences, and I think it was one of the most enriching nights for me, you know, just to have people who understood what the experience was like.
Share that conversation. What was the theme?
I mean, okay, well, so the other three people were men, and, you know, I mean, there are
African-American men who just happened to be at this hostel.
Yeah. And, you know, they talked about similar things, being followed in stores or worrying about if they were hitching with other hikers, if cars would stop for them, you know, if they saw them, you know.
And you're hitchhiking when you're off the trail and looking to get into town or supplies
exactly.
or whatever.
Mm-hmm. Exactly, yeah. Most trail towns are located a little while away, maybe 5 or 10 miles, and the easiest way to get there is by hitchhiking. And, you know, and of course, I mean, that was a concern for me as well. I mean, I never hitchhiked solo. I mean, I think maybe once if I couldn't help it, but for them, you know, I mean, there was just a lot of worry about how their presence would affect how other hikers are treated.
What do you think is the reason that you would meet only 10 African American hikers on this? It's this, anybody can go. It's wide open. It's always available. And you must have passed thousands of people over the course of 2,000 miles.
Yeah,
why so few?
I certainly did. Well, why so few thru hikers, you mean?
African American, yeah.
Yeah, why so few African American thru hikers? Well, racism, a history of racism in America, a history of vulnerability in the woods, a history of not having these activities being advertised and geared toward an African-American population, you know? I mean, we don't, most of these advertisements that you see for backpacking and for camping, they're not, they overwhelmingly are white and feature white people doing these activities. Thru hiking in itself is a ridiculous thing to do. I mean, there aren't that many people, period,
right.
of any race who
yes.
are going to do it. But you know, one of the things when I talk to people about how they got into thru hiking, you know, a lot of it's through family. You know, a lot of them went camping, you know, once or twice with their families or with friends and their families. And you know, exposure has a lot to do with that. And you're talking about people who, you know, were dealing with Jim Crow and dealing with with so much segregation and discrimination throughout the previous century. I, you know, that's not there. I know many black people whose parents would never let them go camping, you know, when I was growing up. And so I think a lot of it has to do with that.
You quote Evelyn White from her essay in 1999, Black Women in the Wilderness, saying, she writes, "For me, the fear is like a heartbeat, always present while at the same time intangible, elusive, and difficult to define. And you write, in wilderness, she does not see freedom, but a portal to the past, a trigger, the history of suffering too much to be overcome. It says to the minority, be in this place and someone might seize the opportunity to end you. Mm. Jeff, in Asheville, North Carolina. Jeff, thank you for calling. You're on the air.
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
Hi, Rahawa.
Hi, Jeff.
First of all, I shared your experience about 17 years ago. I threw Hike Northbound in 2000.
Oh, congratulations, Nobo.
Thanks. It was a wonderful experience. And I wanted to thank you for being a champion for this trail, which is a unit of the National Park System, and for the experience. Because there are not enough champions who speak out on behalf of this incredible, incredible experience.
Yeah.
I work in conservation, and one of the things that all land management agencies and all nonprofits are trying to do is to cultivate a more diverse set of stewards and champions for these special places, because our demographics as a country are changing.
Yes.
And there's a lot of concern about the future for these places if we don't have people who will stand up and speak out if development threatens the trail or other national parks. So it's wonderful to have you speaking out on behalf of the AT.
Thank you so much, Jeff. And I agree with you. That's one of my big concerns, too. I mean, if people, you know, this country isn't going to be a white majority, you know, by the end of the century, I think by 2050. And I think that, you know, unless people love, I mean, you want people to love the outdoors, because if they do, then they're going to care about what happens to them. And I don't think it's an if. The trail is threatened. I think now is, and I think there are enough indicators right now to show that many wild spaces in America are currently under threat.
How is it threatened?
Politics. A head of the EPA that I don't believe he has wilderness's best interest at heart. I think that there are many people and many interests, oil, gas, who see an opportunity, who see a chance to bleed these places of their resources, and not put what they mean to people first.
Jeff, I appreciate your call from Asheville. Let me get Javon calling from Tampa, Florida. Javon, thank you very much for calling. You're on the air.
Thank you. My family, we grew up going camping and whatnot, so I think I got some early exposure. But I think for African-Americans who live in the rural communities, I think they and I could say we are engaging in the outdoors and maybe some place in ways that aren't being tracked. And that can be something as simple as going fishing or just enjoying a walk through the woods or something like that. There may not be at a national park, but my family and I, we get out to state parks and national parks when we can. But and I can't let it go unnoticed. I just got off the highway a few minutes ago or off some back roads in rural Polk County near Tampa, and I saw Confederate flags flying on some of the houses there. So I think the anxiety around who you might encounter when out in the wilderness is a very real thing. When you see trucks with Confederate flags or other things that might indicate that somebody may have some prejudice. But I think that we enjoy being in the outdoors just as much as everybody else. But just as whether we're in the city or in a rural space, we have that extra concern about our safety, given the history of the country and even what's going on today.
The history is real.
Yeah, and John, I mean, you touch on two very important points, and ones that I write about in my outside feature, and that's what outdoors are we talking about? Because, you know, when we say, you know, an outdoorsy person is someone who backpacks and who climbs, then we're excluding so many people of color who do other activities. And I've met people. I have a friend who told me that she went trail running, you know, around Virginia, near D.C., all the time, and she would never consider herself an outdoorsy person, even though the word trail is right in the activity's name.
Or people who fish, as Javon says.
Exactly, or people who fish, or people who do anything. And I think that needs to change. That definitely needs to change. And I'm so glad that you and your family enjoy camping. And, you know, I think at the end of the day, if a person doesn't feel comfortable in America, or if a person is anxious about their movement throughout America, it's not like they're going to be less anxious in a place where they're more vulnerable.
Yeah, Rahawa Hale writes about it for Outside Magazine. She's with us today from Berkeley, California. Javon, thanks for your call from Tampa. Carolyn Finney joins us right now from Lexington, Kentucky. She's a professor of geography at the University of Kentucky, and she's author of this book, Black Faces, White Spaces, Reimagining the Relationship of African Americans to the Great Outdoors. Carolyn Finney, welcome. Thanks for joining us.
Yeah, hi, Tom. Thanks for having me. And Rahawa, I'm so glad to speak with you. Your article is fabulous, and congratulations on completing that hike.
Thank you so much.
I love your book.
I've recommended it to everyone. It's a love fest.
You've made a whole study of this, Carolyn. I mean, we've heard from Rahawa, and we just heard from Javon, I think, pretty clearly about why there might be some reluctance here. But where does this relationship stand now? And what about the image of who goes where in this country?
Yeah. Well, you know, you had it right. It's reimagining the relationship.
Okay.
But the idea of imaging is in there, too, representation. Oh, gosh. And they both hit on so many things that are so right on that I talk about and that I feel, too, as an African-American person. The history of this country, for me, I say to people, you know, race has always been an issue and is still an issue in this country, the issue of difference. You know, we see somebody who doesn't look like us. We have a deep embedded history in our consciousness as Americans. It's real. It's there. It doesn't make a difference if you go into a nice park or a nice forest or sit along a nice river. It doesn't suddenly evaporate. You know, our inability to really, you know, bridge that difference and see each other differently is still there. It's something we're still working on. Why would it be any difference in the outside? The idea that we had Jim Crow segregation in place for many, many years, it didn't matter if you were going to a forest or a park or sitting along a nice river. There were still places as a non-white person that you could not feel comfortable in going. Ebony Magazine, a magazine that targets, you know, largely middle-class African-Americans and African-American families. From the mid-1940s when it started, I looked at about 20 issues of that magazine. What they used to do in the summertime, actually, they had a summer supplement where in the middle of the magazine, they would have images of black people hiking, horseback riding, swimming out with their families, listing all the places you could go in the United States. But it also was telling you where was safe. Like what hotels would accept you, where you could feel safe and secure with your family and do these things. So I want to totally underscore what Rahawa and some of your callers were saying, that it's not about African Americans don't care and haven't been doing it. We're like everybody else. We need non-human nature to survive. We're very diverse. We care about it. But our ability collectively to move around in the same way and make choices in the same way has been affected, and we're not the only group to feel that way. I want to say, you know, Tom, I noticed, you know, you said it's wide open, right? The trail.
Well, I mean, technically, anybody can just get on it.
I'm glad technically anyone can go. Mm-hmm. But there's sort of this universal understanding that anyone, you know, who is that anyone? And largely who we see advertised is large most of the time, though it's changing, that person's white and largely male and largely young. Actually, we have a very particular type that we put out there. And, you know, we're very diverse as human beings. There's all kinds of people that we look, you know, that look different. I want to say to Rahawa as well that, you know, I was laughing when you were saying you lived in New York for 7 years and then at 32, because I was like, I lived in New York for 11. And then when I took off I went backpacking around the world, and I spent the better part of 5 years saving my money and going back out and backpacking.
Good you.
I was actually, you know, so 6 months through the coast of, through East Africa, and I spent a year and a half in Nepal and, you know, hiking Everest and doing all that stuff. I was actually more comfortable doing it abroad than I was doing it here. You know, I'm older now, so there's some other issues at play. But I want to say that there was something, even in running to people abroad, particularly Americans, who didn't think I was American. It was the strangest thing, because I looked like a backpacker with my big backpack on my back and the hiking gear, you know, all the stuff.
Why didn't that sounds very American? Why didn't you think you were American?
Because often they thought I was Israeli or Brazilian or Maori. I've heard
because they couldn't put the image of a person of color together with the American of color.
I mean, because they would be very nice about it.
Yeah.
You know,
oh, people,
and I'd be talking to him, and I'd just say, I'm from New York. Like, I'm, you know, I'm so American. You know, all you have to do is talk to me for 5 minutes and you pick it up. But I understood, I really understood, at least from my perspective, that I look strange. And I want to say this, too, and I hope that, you know, I don't offend anyone by saying this, but I want to say that there were also African Americans who said to me back home, why are you doing that? That's not a black thing to do.
Same.
Or that's a white thing.
Hey, hold that thought. We have to take a short break. I want to go to that. Carolyn Finney, author of Black Faces, White Spaces. Please stand by. And Rahawa Hale, who's written the big article for Outside Magazine, Going It Alone. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back.
Support for On Point and the following message comes from Rocket Mortgage by Quicken Loans. When it comes to the big decision of choosing a mortgage lender, it's important to work with someone you can trust who has your best interests in mind. With Rocket Mortgage, you get a transparent online process that gives you the confidence you need to make an informed decision. Skip the bank, skip the waiting, and go completely online at quickenloans.com/onpoint. Equal housing lender, licensed in all 50 states. NMLSconsumerAccess.org, number 3030.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking about hiking the Appalachian Trail, all 2,190 miles of it, or 2,000 plus anyway, as an African-American woman on her own. Rahawa Hale did it. It gets complicated out there once in a while. Also, beautiful. Here's sound. This is not her, but this is from a 2014 video. Hiker Rowdy finishing the last few steps of the Appalachian Trail way up in Maine, Mount Katahdin. A group of fellow hikers cheer him on from the top as he makes his way up and touches the sign to complete the trail.
Come on, ready!
Get on up here, touch the sign!
Woo!
2,000 plus miles, that is a long hike. And the demographics, not exactly overwhelming African-American, and quite the contrary. Rahawa Hale has written about it for Outside Magazine. You can link to her terrific piece at our website, onpointradio.org. Carolyn Finney is with us as well from Lexington, Kentucky. Professor at the University of Kentucky there. She's written the book Black Faces, White Spaces. What's your question for Rahawa Hale on her hike, on her experience on hiking while black? Do you have a big summer hike planned? Has your skin color come into the planning? Lots of response for you, Rahawa, online. Tankia writes, I think black people are policed so much by whites that we don't feel welcome or safe when trying non-traditional activities. Hold that thought for a second. Your key writes to us, I remember talking to a coworker years ago about my love for outdoors, camping, hiking, and was met with a similar question or assumption of not, therefore, being all black. And Grant writes that he's glad that you mentioned the thru-hikers as good friends that helped you find yourself and save your life in the last paragraph. It says, being that the rest of the article, Grant writes, makes the Appalachian Trail sound like a forested version of the movie Get Out, the Jordan Peele kind of horror film about race relations. A forested version of the movie Get Out, Rahawa?
Yeah. Well, I wouldn't go so far as to call it that. I didn't. but that anxiety is always there. That why are people, especially, you know, why are day hikers in the piece, in the feature I write about my encounter with day hikers who would just say, you know, the craziest things to me.
Well,
I mean, for example, there was the guy who told me that I wasn't black when I told him where I was from. You know, I'm Eritrean American.
Eritrean.
Yeah.
Like first generation or second?
First generation. Oh, yeah. Okay. Yeah. My parents were from there. And, you know, I tell him, yeah, that's I was born here, but that's my identity. Mm-hmm. And he said, oh, okay, well, you're not black then.
What did you take that to mean, that exchange?
That meant for him, that meant that in his mind, black people don't hike. And so if he could peg me to a different identity, then it would make sense why I was out there, what I was doing for 2,000 miles. And that's how I interpreted it. And I tried to tell him, no, listen, you know, I'm very much black. I am treated like a black person in America. And that is, you know, that's my race. But I don't think it came.
He wasn't really buying it.
No, and it was harmless. You know, like these problems, these things, this didn't come from a place of malice, you know?
Mm-hmm.
He wasn't trying to be cruel. Like, this was a normal conversation for him. And staggering, but it's also exhausting because it's, you know, that's what you come across, you know, it's this kind of benign ignorance, which is, you know, to be clear, much better than what I might have encountered, you know, in 1916, I imagine, as a person of color in a wild space.
I mean, we all bring what, you know, what we carry to a trail hike. I mean, I did love your description of your grandmother when you were young on walks in Miami, and she would talk about the tum nifas.
Yeah, tum nifas.
Tum nifas, thank you.
Yeah, yeah.
Is that an Eritrean word, phrase?
It's Tigrinya, yeah. It means like a delicious wind, like a nourishing wind.
Who doesn't know that feeling when you get out where it smells good and you're just out away from things?
Exactly. And that's, you know, and that's, I mean, my love of nature started at a very early age, and I feel very lucky that that was the case.
Sarah, in Searsport, Maine, that's not Katahdin, but it's up in Maine. Sarah, thank you for calling. You're on the air.
Thank you. Hi, Tom.
Hi.
I was hoping to touch base with the ladies on two questions. One, it seems like there's a lot of talk of, you know, saving your money, and then you go on these lovely hikes or these lovely trips. Do you think that there's a little too much leaning on affluence to enjoy these free spaces? Or how would you recommend those of us who maybe don't have these means to enjoy this time as well? That's the first question.
Okay, means. Mm-hmm. You got it?
Mm-hmm. Yep.
And let's pick that one up first.
Okay. Right off the bat, this is a very important topic that you brought up.
Takes 6 months. That's 6 months without working. That's not easy
exactly.
for a lot of people.
I mean, there's no separating this from class, you know? I mean, not just saving up for those 6 months, but what do you do after? One of the things that was interesting to many of the international hikers who did the trail last year was the fact that many American hikers didn't have anything lined up for after the hike, and they were just going to see what happens. And to them, that kind of financial instability is just unheard of, you know, but it's incredibly difficult. I'm one of those people who saved up and then I had nothing waiting for me after. I mean, a few assignments, but that's it. But my suggestion to you is, don't let that stop you. If you can't do 6 months, you know, do 3 months, do a month, do whatever you can, do it in sections. You don't have to be a thru hiker to hike the Appalachian Trail or to be in nature. And I think, you know, one of the biggest barriers to entry is that, there are many things that make it seem that way, that make it seem like you need to spend $500 on a tent, you know, $200 on a pack, $200 on a sleeping pad, and so forth. And it amounts to so much money that it seems unattainable. But the truth is, you don't need that much. And I mean, if you don't have the money, then you have the time to do the research to find out what you can get. Just do what you can.
Sarah, stick with us, because I want to get your second question. But Carolyn Finney, what about this issue of means and the demographics of who's out in the outdoors? Is it white people such heavily represented because they've got more affluence?
I think that's a great question that Sarah asked, and I would say that's part of it. As someone who came from a working class background, you know, I understand that. I mean, I had to spend more than a year or so to save the money as well, and I was young enough that I had no debt and I had no responsibility beyond myself at the time when I made that choice. And I also came back to no job, and I had to find, as a matter of fact, I came back and moved in with my parents for 4 months, and I was in my 30s at that time. So I really get that. I want to be careful, because I think that's not the primary reason why people aren't doing it. But the point that I really want to make is, you actually don't have to go anywhere in order to discover non-human nature and what's exactly where you live, particularly for people in cities. And I'm saying this all the time, because it's fabulous if we can all, you know, get on a trip and do the Appalachian hike or go to national parks. I support all of that. I served on the National Parks Advisory Board for 8 years, so I support all of that. But at the end of the day, everybody can't do it. Not everybody wants to do it. The thing is, non-human nature is around us. It's always around us. So how do we care for what's right in front of us? You know, what about that park on the corner, the local place where people hang out? What about those trees that are along the thruway? What about, you know, urban gardens? There's all kinds of things happening around us. And what happens when we start taking care of those spaces as much as those more iconically beautiful spaces that are out there?
Hey, Sarah, in Maine, you got one. one more.
Yes, thank you both so much. That was very thoughtful, responsive, and helpful. My last question is really just concerning kind of hiking while female. I really enjoy being outside, but often my family will say, "What are you doing? Don't go alone. You're basically going to end up probably raped in a ditch somewhere." And I say that kind of lightly, but I mean,
it's not light.
I couldn't imagine hitchhiking and not having that fear. So what would you recommend, or how do you stay safe?
Rahawa?
Well, as I said, I didn't hitchhike alone, you know, and when it comes to the trail, there are so many people that that's not an issue. You can find somebody to hitchhike with more often than not. But I'd say, you know, it's exactly like it is in day-to-day life, you know. Don't do anything dumb. You know,
but
you
it's not exactly like everyday life. You're on the Appalachian Trail. You're in the middle of nowhere sometimes.
That's true. That's true. And I mean, you're to an extent, that's true. But I mean that you in everyday life as a woman, mm-hmm. you take precautions to make sure that you're not going to be harmed, right? That you're not going to be followed home, that you're not, you know, and it's not on you. The worst, you know, I'm not saying this as though that's on you. It's unfortunate that it's on you, but it's not on you. But it's stuff that you do. You just have to do it twice as much when you're on your own and in the middle of nowhere.
Sarah, I don't know if that's enough advice to get you going, but it sounds like you're really have it at the back of your mind, and we wish you luck with it. One more here. Let's go all the way from Maine to Miami, where Rahawa Hale grew up. Benny's calling. Hi, Benny. You're on the air. What do you know?
Yeah, hi, Tom. Thanks for letting me on. I just wanted to share. I was born and raised white boy down here, South Florida.
Yep.
And I always fished with black friends, even to this day. And I think it's, and we've gone out into some very rural areas and some backwaters, and I think it's underreported. But I did want to share about, for anybody, many years ago, getting out remote can be scary for anybody, regardless of your culture, your skin color.
Yep.
Many years ago, I was on a canoe trip in Central Florida, and we got lost and went off on the wrong fork and got into some very backwater areas. And at first I thought, oh, no, no problem. These people, if we see, and we saw some people out there that kind of scared us. And at a certain point it occurred to us, you know, we're several miles from even a dirt road. What can go on out here, you know, can go unknown forever.
Yeah.
And it's a scary moment. It can come over you, again, black or white, when you realize, hey, we're far from the protections of the law.
Yeah.
So I just wanted to add that, and I don't think it is specific to any particular race.
I appreciate that, Benny. Carolyn, there's a little universal response. I mean, there have been whole movies about that, too, and they didn't necessarily have black protagonists.
You mean about people, you know.
Oh, Deliverance and all that jazz.
Yes. Oh, yeah. Da-na-na-na-na. Yes. So I have a couple things I want to say, and thank you to the caller as well. I also lived in Miami for a year, and one of the things I kept pointing out was that how invisible people who were fishing, how invisible they became when it came to counting how many people are in the outdoors, number one. Number two, absolutely, you know, as human beings, it's scary to get lost, okay? So I absolutely agree with that. And I want to say that where we, I guess I would caution us as, but what that means, how we're able to respond to that is going to be different. You know, as a woman versus a man, it might be different. As an older person versus a younger person, as a more experienced person in the outdoors or a less experienced person, as a person with brown skin or who speaks a different language versus potentially a white person, there may be some different responses to that just in terms of, you know, wherever we go, there we are, right? Wherever you go,
there you are.
As yourself.
Yep.
And the larger context doesn't evaporate because you're out in the woods. So in part, it's how we're able to understand it, how we do our research too, right? I as everybody was talking, I was thinking about John Krakauer's book Into the Wild, and that story. One of the most powerful things for me was both that this young man just wanted to take this great risk and he challenged how he saw life and go out into the wilderness, but on the other side of that, I don't know that he had the level of respect and understanding about what it meant to go into the Alaskan wilderness and how heartbreaking that was. I mean, and the reality of non-human nature, right?
Yes.
How much bigger than us it is.
Yeah,
right?
It's not a coffee shop always out there.
It's not a coffee shop, that's right.
One more here. Angela in Virginia Beach, Virginia. Angela, thank you for calling. You're on.
Hi, Tom. I know we're short on time, and this has been such a fantastic discussion about race and gender and nature and everything. There's so much I want to say, but I know there's not time.
Go.
So I just want to say...
What's your story?
I just want to say I'm 42. I'm half black. I'm half white. I grew up in Denver, and my mom always took me camping, and I've always loved nature, and I'm continuing the tradition with my own kids. Here in Virginia, and we usually go into one of the national or one of the state parks, actually, in Western Virginia, all over.
Great.
And I've never experienced any type of racism or anything from whites. However, every time I announce to my friends that it's time for my annual rafting, camping, hiking trip, I get all the ridicule comes from my black friends.
What do they say? What's to ridicule?
They say that's your white side. How can you do that? You're ruining your kids.
Yeah.
Ruining? Okay, I don't want to sound so incredulous. What does that mean, ruining your kids?
It means I'm not exposing them to their black culture. They're white. Their father's white, so you can't tell they're actually of color, but so they feel like I'm ruining them, and it breaks my heart, but I forgive them at the same time, because I recognize that, and in my opinion, based on my experience, and I think about this a lot, I think that it comes from way back in the slavery days, when the black culture, the black community, mm-hmm. comes from a place where, why would you ever want to go out into the woods? Because, I mean, that's where they were forced to live a lot of times, you know.
Yeah, I guess unless you want to make a long hike north, would be one reason. Angela, our time is short now, it's true, and so forgive me, but I got to take it to Rahawa and Carolyn. Rahawa, what about that reaction from other African Americans? Angela gets incredulity.
Yeah.
From black
friends. I can completely see where that comes from. One of the black hikers I interviewed for my feature, my outside feature, Boomer, is from South Carolina. And when he told people that he was doing the trail, you know, there were black people, they were just completely surprised.
They thought he was crazy, or he wasn't true to his culture?
Well, they thought it was a white thing. They absolutely thought it was a mm-hmm, white thing. Mm-hmm. And I don't know that they accused him of not being true to his culture, but they definitely said that's a white thing to do. And this is something that you hear a lot. I mean, not just with nature, but, back in the day, why do you talk that way? You know, you sound white.
Carolyn Finney, are you going to turn that around? Are you going to change that?
Yeah.
we got 20 seconds.
I mean, I have 20 seconds to keep in mind that everyone in this country, regardless of the color of their skin, has been fighting to sort of identify who we are. Black people in particular have been doing that. I mean, so part of that claiming that is being able to say who, it's really asking the question, who are we and who do we want to be? You know, do we want to limit ourselves in imagining what we can do, where we can show up and who we are? Or do we want to throw that wide open and consider the possibility that we can do anything?
That's a great question. Let me leave it right there because I have to. Yep. Carolyn Finney wrote Black Faces, White Spaces. Thank you. And Rahawa Hale, her piece, Going It Alone, from Outside Magazine, at our website. Rahawa, you're terrific. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you for having me, Tom.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.